NPR Music presents this encore broadcast of Jazz Profiles. We'll hear about the life and music of Jay McShann. He passed away in 2006 at the age of 19.
Mr. Hootie, play that 88. I feel like doing the boogie, so please don't make me late.
Hey, Hootie, what it is?
That's my chair's nickname. He's the one to call Whiskey Hoot.
And Hootie he became. Jay Hootie McShann, legendary Kansas City pianist and bandleader whose big band of the 1930s and 40s delivered the rompin' stompin' Kansas City swing to the doorsteps of America. Music imbued with foot-patting rhythms, boogie-woogie beats, and the quintessential Kansas City crying and shouting blues.
Jay McShann was always close to the blues. I mean, in everything that the man does, you can hear the blues.
Radio producer Bob Porter.
So that he could be playing Honeysuckle Rose or he could be playing I Got Rhythm, and you still hear the blues in what he does. You get it straight down the middle with both hands.
His right hand running the keyboard. I can't explain it.
Singer Jimmy Witherspoon.
He's so great, you know. Art Tatum says he's the greatest pianist, blues pianist in the world.
What makes him so successful is his ability to project his music to the audience.
Record producer John Norris.
He makes people feel good, whether they're young or old.
When you talk about Jay McShann being able to swing, Jay McShann, Mary Lou Williams, Count Basie.
Writer and radio host James Condell.
These were the piano players out of Kansas City who had a style that nobody else had, and it's going to take many years before some music theorist is going to be able to sit down and analyze that, and so other people can do it.
He's got a style unto himself, and he's been one of the largely unsung heroes in jazz for the past 60 years. I'm Nancy Wilson on this edition of Jazz Profiles, a tribute to Jay Hootie McShann. It's no small task to capture what it is that defines the Kansas City style that evolved in the 1930s. Maybe to get at the style, you need to get at the place which so seductively drew in musicians like trumpeter Piggy Miner and violinist Claude Williams.
They were having a good time. I mean, it was one of them things, you know. Kansas City is a place where, you know, if you want to have some fun and you want to make some money or drink some Eignet all, well, come to Kansas City.
Nightclub in there. Sweep out in the morning, open until the next morning, all day, all night, until the next morning. They clean it out, open right back up again. Didn't have to never go to bed if you didn't want to. Somewhere to go at all times.
Kansas City was the fiefdom of the legendary boss Tom Pendergast, who made sure that even during the depths of the Great Depression, the money rolled in and Kansas City never slept.
That was one side of life I hadn't been exposed to. And I needed that exposure, you know.
Wide-eyed and only 21 years old when he rolled into Kansas City in 1937, Jay McShann knew right off the bat that there was something different about the place.
I credit it to Pendergast because Pendergast, he just opened the town up, you know. And quite naturally, when you open the town up, you see, you might as well face it. You see, you're going to take the old pimps and the girls. Those are the towns they're looking for. And then you take musicians, the places that they're looking for. Any place that's wide open, most people, 95% of the people, is looking for a town like that. That's why they tell you, man, such and such town is wide open, man, wow. Yeah, man, yeah, you can make it. You can get action round the clock, 24 hours a day.
This wasn't to say that Kansas City was a forgiving land of opportunity. You had to be smart, meet the right musicians, and as Piggy Miner discovered, you had to be able to play.
It was almost like you had to inhabit the place, you know, and hang around with people, you know. They didn't want to find out who you are, you know, or whether you can play or not. If you couldn't play enough, they'd tell you, you know, well, man, you come back next time, you know what I mean.
there were many, hundreds back there who were just struggling musicians who gave it up, took day jobs.
James Condell.
But Jay was able to persist in it. Here was a young man in his early 20s who had come out of Muskogee, Oklahoma, who had seen the bright lights. And that's a dangerous place to be. That's a dangerous place to be, but he survived it.
Maybe Jay survived it because he'd been thirsting for music ever since he got his first taste back in Muskogee, Oklahoma, where he was born January 12, 1916. The problem was, as he quickly discovered growing up, his taste wasn't the same as his parents.
They thought My Blue Heaven was it. They'd put My Blue Heaven on and I'd be, you know, I liked it all right, but I thought they carried it to the extreme, you know. It was just like I just made a frown.
Day is ending, birds are wending, back to the shelter long, each little nest they long.
If I heard it and I liked it, I knew whether I liked it or not. Because it was just like one day, my dad worked at furniture company, and they would, when they got records that was just nicked or something, they'd be in the truck, you know, and so I know that they was going to throw those records away. So I just take them out every time he'd bring a bunch of that stuff home in the truck. I remember one day they had a record in there by James P. Johnson and I think it was Bessie Smith and James P. Johnson. And I put that record on, and boy, I knew I liked that. And that, the name of that record was Backwater Blues.
Backwater Blues done caused me to pack my things and go. Backwater Blues done caused me to pack my things and go.
When I heard that, I knew what I liked. And I searched every record that he brought home, trying to find something else like that.
Jay's choice of piano was actually by default.
At school, he tried to get my parents to get me a horn, you know. And I always thought I wanted to play a horn. But my folks was too poor, and they couldn't buy me no horn. They tried every way to try to get me a horn, but they couldn't afford a horn for me. So that left nothing but the piano, so I guess that's the reason that I would fool around on the piano every once in a while, you know.
Self-taught, Jay picked up what he could by ear. He listened to records, radio, other musicians around town, and tried things out at home on the family piano when his parents weren't listening too carefully.
My folks, they didn't want me to play nothing but church music, you know. But I could get by with that if my grandmother was over. See, after I get through playing church music for her, she says, "Now play me some of that other stuff, son, you know." Well, you know, I'd look around and see if the old man, he'd be reading the paper, you know. I could get by with it. You know, our kids, they enjoy that, doing, you know, bucking their parents, you know.
In his teens, Jay joined up with several regional bands in Oklahoma, Kansas, and New Mexico, where he gained his first professional experience as a performer. He was also following the music of Earl Hines, Duke Ellington, and the Great Territory bands of the Southwest. In 1937, a time when jobs were few and far between, Jay decided to head north to Omaha, Nebraska, where he had an uncle. But he landed in fate's hands and got off the bus halfway in Kansas City, Missouri.
You see, there was a bus stop. I was riding the bus to Omaha. and there was a layover about an hour and a half in Kansas City. So I didn't know what to do over the layover, and so I asked. I always knew that Basie was working at the Reno Club.
Needless to say, Jay didn't make it back on that bus. Count Basie had left Kansas City by then, but as Bob Porter cites, there were still plenty of reasons to stay.
Kansas City was a great town for big bands. There was a tradition that had gone back to the 20s with the George E. Lee Band, with T. Holder's Band, which later became Andy Kirk's 12 Clouds of Joy. The Oklahoma Blue Devils were headquartered in Kansas City as much as anywhere else, and the legendary Benny Moten Band, which evolved into the Basie Band. So there was plenty of talent and plenty of bands.
It was an environment in which musicians learn from each other. James Condell.
Jay knew nothing about the blues before he came to Kansas City. But when he got to Kansas City, there were two men who turned him around. There was a piano player named Pete Johnson. And Pete Johnson played in this joint. There's no other way to call this thing. It's a joint. And the bartender was Joe Turner. And Pete was an exponent of the blues, the boogie-woogie, the barrel house music that really would fit into an all-night type of dive in which they worked. And then Joe would sometimes join in then and start to singing these things.
I've got a gal, lives up on that hill.
Happy as a baby boy, you know. I heard Joe and Pete, they was just sitting up there, nobody was doing anything, so he's rolling Pete. So Pete started playing. Pete played and the band played for about 15 minutes. Then old Joe started singing the blues. Joe sung for about 15 minutes. And he went back to Pete. Rolling Pete, let him jump for joy. Yeah, man, happy as a baby boy, you know.
Rollin' Pete with Pete Johnson on piano and Joe Turner singing the blues, recorded in 1938. You're listening to Jazz Profiles, a tribute to Jay McShann on NPR, National Public Radio.
Bye-bye, baby. Bye-bye.
The boogie-woogie and stride of Pete Johnson, the shoutin' blues of Big Joe Turner, the hard-swingin' big bands of Benny Moten and later Count Basie. They all contributed to the Jay McShann sound that would become the backbone of the band Jay put together. It grew from just a few guys in 1937 to a full-fledged big band in just a couple of years. Some of the best musicians in Kansas City found their way into the Jay McShann Band. They included bass player Gene Ramey, drummer Gus Johnson, trumpeters Orville Piggy Minor and Bernard Buddy Anderson, tenor saxophone player Bob Maybang, alto saxophone player John J.J. Jackson, and, as no one will ever forget, a young but ripening Charlie Parker. All of them barely in their 20s, but they quickly created a reputation as a shining local riff band that caught people's attention with tunes like Hootie Blues, Vine Street Boogie, and this one, Swing Matism.
We we're all working for the same thing. We all try to put the best musical job out that we know, you know. So if the reed section is rehearsing, somebody out of the rhythm section might holler, "Wait a minute, man. Hold it right there, fellas. Listen, when y'all do this, let's do this like this. When y'all make this phrase, let's phrase this this way." So just from what he did, by everybody in the band helping to shape it up.
It was a band that functioned by democratic means. Jay shouldered most of the responsibility for the group. He was the front guy, the leader. But he didn't impose a personal vision on them. Piggy Miner.
He wasn't the type of person that wanted to be a leader. He was just hanging around. And they just automatically appointed him. You know, "You're it." "Yeah, you're it," you know what I mean? So boogity boogity boogity, here we go again, you know what I mean?
See, I didn't know that much. By me not knowing that much, it kept me open all the time. And I think that's what really helped the band a lot. Sometimes you play certain tunes, then after the guys get through freeze and everybody gets their idea in there, it's a completely different thing that we started out playing. It's a different tune, different everything. Because what this guy came up with, that guy came up with, when they got through, it was a complete different tune.
Sepian Bounce, written and arranged by Jay McShann and Archie Skip Hall. According to Bob Porter, the Jay McShann Band had that quintessential Kansas City swing that largely flowed from the band's rhythm section.
The best way of describing it is the essence of swing. It is just right on the beat kind of swing, but loose and relaxed, never frantic.
Swinging, I always felt like this. That you got to graduate to the point where you can grab the bull by the horn if you have to. If you got to grab him and pull him in here like this. See what I mean? See, when the horn say, see, there's a give and a take, see? He's pushing here, and then when he comes down and lit lightens up, well, he's resting, he's coasting. Well, he was pushing up here, now he can coast when he gets back here.
Thank you.
gradually working on back to where it coasts. Coasts here, pushes up here, pushes from here going up.
Duke and the Brute. That's the J. McShann Orchestra with tenor saxophonist Ben Webster. Swing. It's what got the band the gigs, not just in Kansas City, but throughout the country.
Louder and funnier. Play that thing. Louder and funnier.
On a trip to the University of Kansas in Wichita, after hanging out with some of the students, the musician stumbled into what is now the earliest known recording of the J. McShann Band, made on November 30th, 1940. James Condell.
So then when they went to play this little job in Wichita, which is there's a university there, some enterprising young person, there's always one or two somewhere, wanted to put this on the air and at the same time make an acetate. Acetate was the recording technique of that time. And so they did. That became something that was preserved for posterity.
You hear in this rendition of Honeysuckle Rose a pure representation of the band's sound, because they weren't yet playing for a record producer's ear, just their own. Piggy Miner wasn't aware that these recordings existed until recently.
Jay's playing like this. What you gonna slide? This is Gus, I think. That's Buddy. I can keep playing the river band. I think they're gonna fade out on this. That's Bruce.
Honeysuckle Rose. Recorded in 1940 with Piggy Miner and Buddy Anderson on trumpet, Charlie Parker on alto sax, William Scott on tenor sax, Bud Gould on violin, Gene Ramey on bass, Gus Johnson on drums, and J. McShann on piano. It was 1940, and the J. McShann Band was on its way. As we'll hear, changes and progressions, not just musically speaking, were in the air. I'm Nancy Wilson, and you're listening to a tribute to J. McShann on Jazz Profiles from NPR, National Public Radio.
Thank you.
In 1941, a new addition to the J. McShann Band changed its sound. His name, Walter Brown.
Ain't you sorry, babe, you played me for your fool? Ain't you sorry, babe, you played me for your fool? Drove me from your door and you broke love's golden rule. How I wanted you, babe, you looked so good to me. How I wanted you, babe, you looked so good to me. But you're no good woman and you ranked yourself with me.
The lyrics that he's saying, and just like he's talking to you.
Trumpeter Piggy Miner.
He didn't try to jump in into some other lingo and expressing these songs. He spent some time with the lyrics. And generally when it's about women, but I mean, you can enjoy what he's saying, you know what I mean? He would be talking, you know, how shaped she is or whatever, you know, he would go into that thing.
Someday, someday, I don't know the time or place. Someday, someday, I don't know the time or place. You're gonna ask my forgiveness, I'll laugh right in your face. When your friends ask about me, please don't bring me down. When your friends ask about me, please don't bring me down. It's not all my fault, I could still mama be around.
Walter Brown's lyrics and lilting vocal style sealed the deal for the band's first contract with a record label, Decca, for whom they recorded their biggest hit in 1941. Writer and radio host, James Condell.
I was walking down the street in Louisville, it's Warner Street, Louisville, Kentucky, with a buddy of mine, musician buddy and high school buddy of mine, C.B. Williams. And in those days, in the black neighborhood, in the record stores, they would have the speakers out on the street so you could hear the music as you walked up and down the street blaring at you. And there was this song, Confessing the Blues, and this piano player playing it. And of course, it was J. McShann with Walter Brown singing. And C.B. told me, you better start listening to this guy. He's going to be good. He's going to be great.
Baby, here I stand before you with my heart in my hand. I want you to read it, mama, hoping that you'll understand. Well, baby, mama, please don't dog me round. I'd rather love you, baby, than anyone else I know in town. Because you're so nice and loving, and you have such pleasing ways. If you take me to your home, be there the rest of my days. That's the truth, mama. Well, you know I wouldn't lie if I don't love you, babe. Well, I swear I hope to die. Well, baby, don't you want a man like me? Well, baby, don't you want a man like me? You think only about future, forget about your used to be. When my days are long and dreary and the sun refuses to shine, I would never be blue and lonely if I knew that you were mine. Well, baby, will you make everything all right? Can I have you today, babe, or will it be tomorrow night? This is my confession, mama, and I'm thrilled by all your charms. Well, it seems that I'm in heaven when you hold me in your arms. Well, babe, you can't have me for yourself. You are meant for me, mama. I don't want nobody else.
Confessing the Blues, with lyrics by Walter Brown and music by Jay McShann, recorded in 1941. With its simple, unassuming sound and message, Confessing the Blues propelled the Jay McShann Orchestra far beyond the borders of Kansas City and the South.
Bill Abernathy speaking in behalf of the Blue Network, inviting you now to listen to a brand new dance orchestra. First time on the Blue Network, and it comes to you direct from the Savoy Ballroom, one of America's most famous dancing places, way up in Harlem in New York City. The name of the leader and the owner and director of the band is Jay McShann. Jay is going to offer for his first tune tonight the St. Louis Mood. All right, Jay, you're on the air for the first time. Let's go.
Opportunities such as this broadcast from the Savoy Ballroom in 1942 were a platform not only for the band as a whole, but also for its outstanding soloists. James Condell.
The story goes that it was Ben Webster who called attention to Charlie Parker, and he started telling all the musicians downtown, you better come up to Harlem and listen to this guy, Charlie Parker, the Jay McShann Band. He is setting things on fire.
Bird would never ever get what was due him. See, a guy, after you hear a guy play so long, and you hear all that stuff that he's doing at night, and when he got through blowing, you didn't hear no hands behind him. Jimmy Forrest was in the band in the same section. Jimmy Forrest get through blowing, they'd just holler and scream and carry on, and Bird just blowed everything that was to blow in front of him. I couldn't understand. See, he was ahead of his time, Z.
Record producer John Norris.
I guess from a historic point of view, the irony is that, of course, is that most people remember that band because it had Charlie Parker in it.
Charlie Parker's legendary skill was paralleled by his problems, chiefly an all-consuming drug habit that kept him bouncing in and out of the band until Jay had to let him go in 1943. In a way, the problems with Bird appeared to foreshadow the fate of the orchestra itself. On an unforgettable night in 1944, the thick of World War II, Jay's band played their last job.
That night at the hall, a couple of fellas come up to me and told me, says, we've got some business to talk with you, and a very important business. So I said, okay.
Yeah, the man come up. I said, are you Jay McShann?
Piggy Miner.
I want to talk to you a minute. Called me. They were businesslike. Police are anyway. And Jay played crazy on them a little bit, you know. And what is it, man? What? Cat? That's what we're talking. Can I help you? You know.
So they came up to me the second time and told me, says, we'd like for you to take about this 3 minutes. We'll explain everything to you. So they took me over to the corner and told me, showed me the papers and everything. Says, we taking an oath to bring you in tonight. They says, and here on your paper, they've got two red eyes. That means immediate induction.
Jay was drafted into the Army straight off the bandstand, with no time to even consider the gravity and significance of the situation. Aside from the audience waiting for him to get back up on the bandstand that night, which he never did, the band had a year's worth of advance bookings that they wouldn't make. Despite the confusion of the moment, there was one detail that Jay did not let slip by. That was his concern for the valuable arrangements that had been compiled over the years.
So I told my manager, I said, the only thing I ask you to do is be sure and take the music with you. But he didn't come down till the next day. He says he didn't come down the next day. He figured it just overnight. But he come down the next day, and the guy told him, he says, well, there's two young guys come in here this morning, and that's all that they took. They only took that trunk that you was talking about.
James Condell.
The book was gone. The library was gone. And Jay had cautioned those guys as he left the bandstand, be sure somebody take the book home with you tonight. Don't leave that here. And it's never been found. And I think that there is, in somebody's basement, J. McShann's library, that the people who have it don't know what they have. It must be a fabulous thing, because some of those arrangements are written by the young guys in the band. Some are written by established, well, later established arrangers like Ted Dameron, because that's when the whole nature of Jay's band changed. Then they lost its swing.
Discharged from the Army in 1945, Jay tried to reform his band. But the era of big bands was winding down, and the musical landscape was changing dramatically. Small groups were supplanting larger groups. Jay finally had to let his musicians go while out in California. But he stayed on and pieced together various pickup groups.
Greatest pianist in the world. He taught me everything I know.
Singer Jimmy Witherspoon was fresh out of the Merchant Marines with little musical experience when he met Jay in Vallejo, California in 1946.
I was at the dance. He played a dance. And local people asked me to get up, ask him to let me sing.
So Spoon come in, Spoon say, hey, man, where's your blues singer? I said, man, I ain't got no blues singer. He said, well, man, I think I can sing the blues. I said, well, look here, I tell you what, I'll put you on in the blues in a couple of minutes. So I put him on the blues, and he's singing old Kansas City blues, and the house went down. House broke up.
Yeah, I sang Wee Baby Blues, Joe Turner's tune. After I sang that, he asked me, did I want to go on the road?
I said, what are you doing? What are you doing tomorrow? I said, we got to play down here about 100 miles from here somewhere.
I told him yes. He said, well, you got a job. We're playing Stockton tomorrow night.
So I said, let's go.
Well, all the hip cats on the corners, they don't look sharp no more. Yes, all the hip cats on the corners, they don't look sharp no more. Well, cause the good times is over, and the squares don't have no door. Well, since the cops raided all the nightclubs, they don't know what to do. Yeah, since the cops raided all the nightclubs, hip cats don't know what to do. They're standing on every corner, just as beat as me and you. Now listen, listen, fellas, please take some good advice. If you've got a square chick, please treat the poor girl nice. Or else try this method, it may work out good. Just grab the nearest red car and make it out to Hollywood. Yes, cause the hip cats on the corner, they don't look sharp no more.
the square chicks on. Don't have no door no more.
Jay says I communicate with the band. I make the band play better. Jay told me that.
Skid Row Blues, sung by 24-year-old Jimmy Witherspoon with Jay McShann. You're listening to NPR's Jazz Profiles, a tribute to Jay McShann. I'm Nancy Wilson. In 1951, Jay McShann returned to Kansas City to be with his wife and three young daughters. He was embarking on what would be a rough couple of decades. Maybe he sensed this when, at age 36, he enrolled at the Kansas City Music Conservatory to, in his words, try to understand what he'd been doing all these years. He learned composition, theory, technique, analysis, history, and above all, he learned how to read music. He took what gigs he could find, but things were slowing down. They ground to a halt in the summer of 1965, when he didn't land a single job. 3 years later, though, in 1968, Jay's career was given new life. He traveled to Europe for the first time and was met by enthusiastic audiences. And in 1971, he ventured into Canada with another veteran Kansas City musician, also from Muskogee, Oklahoma, Claude Fiddler Williams.
That's a guy that's got some history behind him. And the funniest thing, I didn't know Claude in Muskogee.
I didn't know Jay in Muskogee. I was up here. See, I came up here in 28. And Jay was just getting the groove together.
I don't know how he does it. He only 90 years old. Yeah, I'm damn near dead. And I'm eating down there dead, and Claude, get out there, oh, man. I said, Claude, how'd you make this tour? Oh, it wasn't a bit of trouble. I didn't have a bit of trouble. Not a bit of trouble. Everything's fine. I think he must have a little Creek Indian in him. They don't show much age, and they don't, you know.
With their hard-swinging Kansas City style, Claude and Jay made a great impression in Canada. Record producer John Norris of the Sackville label.
I was so impressed with the band. I mean, it sounded like what I had imagined that music had sounded like in Kansas City in the 1930s. So loose, but yet it wasn't loose. It was just so terrific that the following year, I asked them to make a record, which became The Man from Muskogee, which was the first a recording that we did for Sackville.
Do we sit there with the Fifth Kentucky Club or something, you know, whiskey, and we take a swallow, and like I said, we play a tune down once or twice, maybe three times at the most, and it's a take, next tune, you know.
Yeah, it was done in the studio on a Saturday afternoon, and in the studio, McShann just takes charge. He knows exactly what's going to happen musically and how it's going to be arranged. It was a great afternoon just sitting back there listening to them play. Thank you.
Charlie Parker's Yardbird Suite, with Claude Williams on violin, Don Thompson on bass, Paul Gunther on drums, and Jay McShann on piano.
I think that the Sackville records that were made by Jay McShann open a door which people probably didn't even know existed with Jay.
Radio producer Bob Porter.
Largely because entertainers tend to fall into comfortable patterns after a while. They'll come to a town and the audience who was there that knows him already will be listening for certain things. And Jay McShann could be playing Vine Street Boogie and Four Day Rider and Confessing the Blues every night for the rest of his life. But the Sackville records are wonderful in exposing a side of Jay that probably most people didn't know about.
Like this rendition of Body and Soul recorded live at Toronto's Café des Copains in Whether he's leading a big band, a small group, or just playing solo, Jay McShann has a beautiful sense of phrasing, of harmony. His story is not one of overwhelming fame and glory, however. He doesn't have an agent, and he has never been aggressive in promoting himself. John Norris and Bob Porter.
You know, Jay hasn't, he's managed his own career for a long time, and I'm sure that he's happier with that than if he had put his career in the hands of somebody else.
I think Jay McShann has gotten exactly out of music what he wanted to, in the sense that he's still active, still performing, and still enjoying it. He has had that at every instance that I've ever heard him play, and I think he loves what he does. And I think in the long run, that's exactly what is most important to him.
Jay has now graduated to the venerable status of octogenarian. You wonder if a man of his age might get tired of the music business, the one-nighters, the traveling.
Yes, you do think about chugging it sometimes, yes. A lot of times, yeah, you think about it. I probably would have chugged it, but I haven't found out what is keeping me from doing it. I've always felt this way, that jazz never had no destiny. One guy put a thing down and said, this is a finished product. You don't do that with jazz. You ever notice musicians, they never satisfied. See, because it was something else brought out that you hadn't picked up on before, you know. Music is something to enjoy. Yeah.
Our tribute to Jay McShann was written and produced by Molly Murphy. Post-production engineers were Chuck Thompson and Saria Muhammad. Thanks also to Preston Brown. Special thanks to Sackville Records and CJRT in Toronto, KCUR in Kansas City, WBGO in Newark, New Jersey, and KCCM in Moorhead, Minnesota. Also thanks to Barry Bernard, Ken Poston, Dan Morgenstern, and Marianne Adams. Jazz Profiles is produced by Tim Owens. Assistant producer is Madeline Smith. Website coordinator, Bettina Owens. The executive producers are Mary Beth Kirshner and Murray Horwitz. To email us or for more information about this and other programs in our series, contact us through NPR's homepage on the World Wide Web at npr.org. That's npr.org. Major support for Jazz Profiles comes from the Lila Wallace Reader's Digest Fund, helping people to make the arts part of their everyday lives. Additional support has been provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the National Endowment for the Arts. I'm Nancy Wilson. And how does Jay McShann say goodbye to audiences all over the world?
Bang, bang. Bang, bang.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
You've been listening to an encore broadcast of Jazz Profiles. Pianist Jay McShann passed away in 2006 at the age of 90. Discover more great jazz at NPR Music with our series Live at the Village Vanguard. Live webcasts and archives from America's premier jazz club. Check it out at nprmusic.org.